It's time for the Animal Voices show now. It is 12 o'clock, and this is CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM. And stay tuned. Animal Voices is coming right up.
We have the signature tune. Welcome, everyone, to Animal Voices. Peter Singer, he's the author of Animal Liberation. He said, "All the arguments to prove human superiority cannot shatter this hard fact. In suffering, the animals are our equals." Yes, and Robert Cohen from NotMilk.com, he said, "Non-humans will continue to be exploited until there is a revolution of the human spirit. And that will not happen without visionaries trying to change the paradigm that has become accustomed to and tolerant of patriarchal violence." Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. My name is Carl Loskin. At the controls today in the studio is Alan Jensen. In the studio are co-hosts John Pranger and Olart. And Marge Adams is not with us today. I believe she's going to go and play ping pong today. But anyway, Marge, thank you for always being with us. Dr. Wayne Henry from the Department of Philosophy at Capilano College will be our guest for the full hour today. The subject will be many and varied, so stay tuned. This program is presented to you, Animal Voices, is presented to you by volunteer members of the Vancouver Humane Society, the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society, and Earth Save Canada. The primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. Something wonderful you can do for yourself and all life on Earth is to eat a diet of organic, unprocessed food that is free from animal products. Yes. That says many of our views. And for the third time, and this is the fourth time, we welcome Dr. Wayne Henry from the Department of Philosophy at Capilano College of the Department of Philosophy at Capilano College. Wayne, you've been here three times. Maybe you'd like to just give us a little overview of why we have you here so many times and why we love to have you.
Very good. Thanks a lot. I was thinking about this in preparation for my visit, and I thought it might be helpful to revisit the themes of those earlier talks here as a way of leading up to a particular problem case that might demonstrate how those themes are interconnected. So, for example, the first time I appeared here, I tried to make the case that the arguments for animal rights are based on the idea that at present our view of animals is to think of them rather as objects or resources here for us to exploit as we wish. And there's a long historical tradition in our culture and indeed many cultures that tends to think of animals in this way. Their resources, the use of a cow, for example, is the sum total of its ability to perhaps pull a plow for us or to put meat in her plate or to provide leather to make couches. The use of a dog on this view would be its use to guard our property or maybe even to give us pleasure as a pet. And this view is actually, in fact, strongly reflected in our law where animals are regarded as property. I recall back in 1997, the federal government was attempting to rewrite the laws that protect animals in Canada by revising some of the inherent concepts, including the idea that they're to be viewed as property. And they asked the population at large for submissions, and I wrote a rather lengthy one. I was never graced with the response to that, but I later heard through the animal rights movement. I have many friends in this movement that the bill had actually died in committee, and I was further told by this person that they were actually grateful that it had died in committee. This was someone from the Vancouver Humane Society relayed this to me. They were grateful that it had died in committee because by then it had been so watered down by various interest groups representing the agriculture business and so on that it actually would have resulted in a situation that was worse for animals than it presently is. So to recap, you know, this view is really very strongly grounded in a long historical tradition that views animals as essentially property, as objects here for us to exploit. And to move beyond that, to move to a situation in which we actually extend genuine protections to animals requires that we revise that view, that we come to see animals as, like we see ourselves, as things with an inherent worth, a worth in and of themselves. It's not just their worth that they have to pull or plow, but a worth they have in themselves. That, after all, is the grounding for the human rights tradition. Humans have rights because they have a value in and of themselves, and it's rightly regarded as wrong to interfere with people, to turn them into slaves, for example, because you violate that inherent worth that they have.
So much has changed over the years, even if we don't have any meaningful legislation, but it's that there's a distinction between that we ethically love our pets and there is no meaningful legislation to mitigate the horrendous violence that factory farmed animals endure day and night, and 10 billion of them in North America each year.
That's right. There's absolutely, and it makes no difference at all. The fact that we love our pets and protect them is gives the illusion that animals have a protection that's stronger than it actually is. You see, in fact, even the family dog is still regarded as property, which is why essentially there's nothing wrong with someone saying, oh, well, you know, that dog, it's kind of like that old couch. I really no longer have a place for it in my life. I'm going to give it away or maybe even bring it into the SPCA and surrender it for euthanization. And of course, I mean, that's a worst case scenario. But the truth is also another point is that the animals that are routinely regarded as pets is entirely arbitrary. Why is it dogs and cats as opposed to, say, cows and pigs? And in another culture, it might be. It's entirely arbitrary, and it reflects the view, I think, that, again, we regard animals entirely as objects. Even the pet is, in some sense, not for everybody, not for pet owners, mind you, but the prevailing view in our culture is that that animal that lies in your couch and gives so much to your life is still, its worth is exhausted by the pleasure it gives you in your life.
So Olaart once did a program here on our language, and our language has changed over the years, and certainly I've changed it in that I would never say, is that your dog? Dr. Wayne Henry yeah. has four dogs. No, you're the guardian, you're the, like a parent.
Exactly. You know, my dog is referring to it in proprietary terms. Again, it reflects the view
we
of them as property.
We entrench that view, and when we change our language, then we mitigate that to other people by the way we talk.
Exactly.
Well, also, too, I mean, when we call people, you're a dog, or you're a bitch, or you're whatever, then we are using animal terms, and we mean to degrade people when we use those animal terms. So this gives us an indication that we think of animals as less than less worthy than human beings by using animal names when we address people in a derogatory fashion.
Absolutely, and that raises another point. It would be perhaps a long digression. Whether or not we pursue it is up to you here, but I am of the opinion that we owe feminists, the feminist movement of the 70s in particular, a great debt of gratitude for having really brought to our attention a point that had been made by many people earlier, including George Orwell, that how we use our language really reflects how we see the world and those around us. And feminists have worked very hard to get us to recognize that how we permit ourselves to speak about women has its impacts in behavior. It reflects how we permit ourselves to treat them. And we have really, I think, made a lot of advances with respect to how we speak to women. And it's my sincere hope that presently what we're inching our way towards is a revision of how we permit ourselves to speak about animals, which I think will go hand in glove with a revision of how we think of them. We might cease to think of them as property.
So who was Scully? He wrote a landmark article which said that we have an obligation to the animals rather than we should accentuate that they have rights. Would you agree with that? And maybe just tell us that Scully article. I think he was in the Republican government in Washington quite recently.
I haven't actually read Scully's paper, but I'm familiar with the argument. The idea here is that it's a way of watering down the strength of the protections we would extend to animals. Instead of as soon as you extend rights to animals, if you could perforce accomplish that, it would carry certain very strong limitations on our behavior, on what we would then be permitted to do with them. Understandably, there is a lot of resistance to that from some quarters where the status quo benefits them, particularly, for example, the agricultural industry, agribusiness. So the idea that we have obligations to them is the idea that, oh, sure, they're sensate creatures, they're capable of feeling pain, so we have to take certain precautions in how we treat them. We can't treat them the same way as we treat a rock or a brick. So very well, we'll give them larger battery cages. We'll only put 5 hens into battery cages instead of 7. Or maybe we'll find a new technique involving lasers for debeaking them as opposed to just bluntly cutting them off with a mechanical device. Or, we might introduce similar innovations with respect to how we husband cows or pigs. But it's really, I think that if you feel, as I do, that these animals have an intrinsic worth of their own and are deserving of respectful treatment, then you can't help but regard that sort of movement that Scully advocates as a complete watering down of what we're really trying to accomplish here, which is genuine protection for animals that stems from the recognition that they have a worth in and of themselves just as we do.
So over the decades and millennia, animals have been used in different ways. I mean, we look at biblical stories, and that actually raises many issues here about the usage of animals, especially, there's a whaling, which is a traditional, regarded as a traditional rite in many ways. So maybe you can just touch on this whole idea of that type of sacrifice. Is it truly a sacrifice in this day and age? Can we afford to be put into the limelight, the killing of an animal with all those inherited rights that come with it?
Very good question. Let me first also reintroduce a point from a previous visit. The last time I was here, in fact, in my third visit, I tried to argue that there is indeed no tension between the human rights movement and the animal rights movement. I sometimes get this criticism, for example. People say to me, oh, how can you argue for animal rights? And the implication, the fear on their part is that if you argue for the rights of animals, you're somehow impinging negatively on the rights of people. And I've always tried to argue sternly that the animal rights movement stems from the same basic insights as the human rights movement, and in fact anyone who is genuinely committed to extending real rights to animals has got to be, if they're consistent, also committed to the extension of rights to humans everywhere where humans are exploited. And this is a basic recognition of the fact that, like them, we also are animals.
Well, one thing I wanted to say about that, too, is interesting when you say that people think that somehow you've impinged upon human rights by acknowledging the rights of animals. Certainly people who practice Buddhists or any other such Eastern religions think of animals as having, they have a compassion. They develop a compassion towards all living things. Now, I don't think that they consider that a diminishment of their compassion or empathy towards human beings. Mm-hmm. It's in fact, I could see it as an enhancement of your respect for human beings by your respect for animals without developing any kind of hierarchy in the process.
Absolutely, I agree wholeheartedly, although for most people it can be quite a long distance to get from the one to the other, you know. But to reinforce the point I was making a moment ago, that there's no tension between the animal rights and the human rights movement, I like to put it this way. If you recognize that people have an inherent worth or an intrinsic worth, as we sometimes call it, and that that's the basis for thinking that it's absolutely wrong to do certain things to them, for example, to enslave them or to harm them deliberately, notice we have – there's a way of looking at the history of ethics as the expansion of the charm circle, as I like to call it. What I mean by that is if you go back to the ancient Greeks, the charm circle included only Greek citizens, and it's now well known that citizens, of course, were adult Greek males over the age of 30 only. In other words, it didn't even include women. Ethical thought moved us forward to the point where we recognized that, for example, differences in skin color or differences in religious background were not the sort of differences that justified discrimination and regarding some people as less than fully human. Similarly, I think the movement that extended rights to women, to which we owe so much for so many insights, was founded on the same basic recognition that although there are differences between men and women, we focus on the similarities between us rather than the differences for recognizing that women, like men, are equally deserving of the full range of human rights because they're the important similarities between us. And my point would be that when we look at animals, it is similarly the similarities between them and us that we should focus on rather than the differences. In other words, we shouldn't say, oh, well, they can't speak, they can't reason. In fact, I think there are some challenges to the claim that they can't reason, but even setting that aside for the moment, it's not those differences between us, it's the similarities. They can feel pain, they can feel a wide range of emotions. In many cases, they have a certain degree of self-awareness. They certainly have awareness of the world around them. They're capable of meaningful relationships, both amongst themselves and with us, which is a remarkable thing. And on the basis of those similarities, it's on that basis that I think we must recognize their inherent worth and therefore their just desert to be treated respectfully and to have the most basic rights, which is the right to life and the right to non-interference.
The problem is, to some degree, that in the Judeo-Christian Muslim world that we live in the West, there is a fundamental difference given to humans and other creatures, right? The Judeo-Christian tradition says, you know, that that's a supreme being, you know, created man in his or its image and that is somehow separate from all other creatures, and man is somehow better than all other creatures. And this is a good way to justify the way you treat animals. If you can just say, well, you know, There's a religious foundation for the way we see ourselves in the universe and as well as opposed to animals. And it's a big problem because people who want to practice the agricultural use of animals or hunting or things like that can just point to that and that difference, right?
And but on the other side of that, certainly religions preach about humility. Now, what you're talking about just puffs up the ego enormously, and if you're going to develop humility, as the religions also preach, then I would think then you are going to more recognize what Dr. Henry just said, and that is their intrinsic worth. And
of course,
also,
I mean,
also you're revealing in your tremendous lack of insight if you've never given any thought to the things that Dr. Henry just said with regards to they feel pain, they feel a variety of emotions, they live, they die, they have hearts and lungs, and you know they're very similar to us in many respects, and the fact that we don't even accord them any thought in that respect, or certain of us don't accord them that thought, really reveals a lack of insight. So you can tell a lot about a person by how much they've even thought about it based on their point of view. I mean, they're on the news, they're talking about, because this issue about eggs, you know, because Richmond just said they're going to go no factory
Vancouver farm just
eggs.
Did. yesterday.
No, did they yesterday?
Because they approved it. It's gone.
Okay, but what prior to that,
not
though,
on challenge.
There was this, and I don't know, I can't remember the name of the MP, but he was going, whoa, was it Cadman or something? Anyways, he was going, why should we be concerned about these things with hens? And I'm,
City Councilor Cadman, yes.
Yes, and I was thinking, well, you just exposed to the whole world your lack of insight and your whole callousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and all of these returns us really to the question that Carl posed a moment ago, which is that question about what about, for example, the use of animals in certain religious rites. We intersect all of these various topics here, so it's really a way of sort of demonstrating the interconnections between everything we've been talking about both this morning and in my previous visits. I'll give you just a couple of examples. In Havana, Cuba, there are a number of course, many Cubans who live there, and they practice a religion called Santeria, which, as I don't claim to know a lot about it, but it is apparently mixes elements of Roman Catholicism with voodoo and perhaps some traditional Cuban religions as well. And as part of their religion, they sometimes perform animal sacrifices. My understanding is that it usually involves the use of turtles, but sometimes cats and dogs. And there was a case that went before the Supreme Court of the United States, I think more than 10 years ago, in which their right to use animals in those religious practices was upheld by the Supreme Court of the United States on the grounds that it was the protection to their right to religious freedom. So here we have a remarkable tension on the one hand between human rights and their rights to religious freedom versus, you know, I'm arguing the rights to animals. And I think that when you look at the view that society, that prevails in society at large as reflected in the court judgment, it really reveals that it's not actually about the right to religious freedom. Again, it brings us back to the point about how we regard animals, which is as objects here for us to use, because everyone knows that if there was a religion, say, an ancient Hawaiian religion that said, look, you know, we want to revive our long ceased practices, and central to those is every 5 years we throw a virgin into the volcano, we would say, no, you can't do that. So what's the difference in this case involving animals in the use of religious practices?
So we go back to the original thing here about intrinsic value. And, of course, that I think there was an implication there that you said intrinsic value is because of it has life as opposed to the rock. So were you diminishing the rock? I mean,
I don't for a moment presume that that the rock has any rights and that I have any obligations to the rock. I would like to make one caution though. Intrinsic worth is not necessarily extended to animals just because they have life. There's a range of views here. Some people, for example, extend intrinsic worth to all and only humans on the grounds that all and only humans are capable of rational thought. That claim is open to challenge on a number of grounds. Not all humans have rational thought. Some animals seem to. I think the evidence is, in fact, overwhelming that many animals are capable of rational thought. Horses, elephants, dogs, pigs. But even setting that aside, one might then say, try a different tack. Well, then we'll extend the boundaries of the term circle, that is, we'll recognize those animals to have inherent worth, which are capable of, say, self-conscious awareness, meaningful relationships with others. They have certain preferences. They have memories of the past. They anticipate events in the future. We'll call these beings subjects of a life because they have a unique subjective perspective on the world. This is the view argued for by Tom Regan. And we'll say that that includes many non-human animals. So it's not because they're alive, but rather because they share a cluster of properties with us. Again, we come back to the similarities that bind us, self-conscious awareness, a capacity for meaningful relationships with one another, and indeed meaningful relationships with us, memories of the past, anticipations of the future, a capacity for a wide range of emotions, limited self-conscious awareness and rational thought, and on the list goes.
Well, and if that was the case, though, if those are the reasons why we have to have this whole laundry list of reasons why before we give respect to animals, then I would say, then one could say, well, what about the people that are in the hospital that are in a coma or that are vegetative or something? Because they don't no longer have that laundry list. So now do we say that they're not worthy of being kept alive? They're not worthy of being used or treated in some other derogatory way, that somehow animals don't get the respect because we have to prove first that they have this laundry list, and yet we don't have to apply that same laundry list to people who are in the hospital?
Well, there are two things I'd like to say in response to that. The first thing is, as a philosopher, of course I'm concerned with the reasons that justify our positions. That's just what philosophy is in the business of doing. It is not, I want to caution, though, against the view that it's just a bunch of distracted individuals thinking in terms of difficult abstract concepts. It's not that. As Tom Regan has argued persuasively in his book Animal Rights, this is where changes in human thought, revolutions in human thought begin. They begin with reflection and with understanding the reasons that justify our views, and also with revealing the presuppositions, the assumptions we take for granted. We've been doing that here this morning. We've revealed, for example, the assumption that most people make about animals, which is that they're mere property. So, yes, I am concerned with the reasons, the laundry list, as you put it. But secondly, you pointed out, well, then, if some animal didn't meet that laundry list of qualifications, that would seem to imply that it would not have any inherent worth. And yes, indeed, you could draw that implication. One might say, for example, that the line gets drawn between those animals that have those capacities and those that don't. And as such, it might be that, say, for example, reptiles, frogs, snakes, turtles, fall outside the charm circle. And indeed, some humans who, say, become the victims of head traumas that rob them of those capacities no longer have inherent worth. But I think there's another way of dealing with that. We wouldn't say, this human who was once a fully functioning adult of inherent worth is now no longer has those capacities, therefore no inherent worth, therefore expendable. We'd say continue to extend the basic rights to them on the recognition that they were once a part of our family. That's at least one way of doing it. But another way, a more plausible way, I think, is to do what Tom Regan does, which is this. He says, look, I'm not saying that you have to have this list of qualifications to qualify for inherent worth and therefore the due rights to protection of your most basic rights to life and non-interference. What he is saying is, if you do have those properties, then for sure you have inherent worth, and there might be other reasons in addition that would incline us to grant inherent worth even to those animals and some human beings who don't have those qualifications.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And if you've been finding this somewhat involving and would like to listen to it again, John Pranger, our webmaster, posts this program and many others on our webpage, which is animalvoices.org. Thank you always, John, for doing our webpage, and we'll be able to listen to Dr. Wayne Henry, who is from the Department of Philosophy at Capilano College. We're going to have a little bit of music now, and when we come back, we're going to speak about some environmental challenges, the ethics of it, and our moral obligation that we have. We're going to ask Wayne, what is our moral obligation to restore what is being damaged by us being here? So over to Alan Jensen in the control room.
thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. He'll be there beside the river when winter finally breaks its bones. He'll be king among the rushes, he'll be master of his home. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Safe as Moses in the rushes, makes his home on the river wide. Every time I hear him singing, makes me feel like spring inside. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Singing his heart out, he'll be telling stories too. Where he went to winter last year, how he's going back there too. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road. Thought I heard a red-winged blackbird down my road.
And that was James Keelahan, Red Winged Blackbird, from his CD, Home. And James Keelahan is not in town right now, but I would like to remind you that this upcoming weekend is the Mission Folk Festival. And it's going to be great weather for the Mission Folk Festival, so put that on your calendar for this coming weekend if you don't have anything else happening, because there'll be lots of great local performers like James Keelahan there, as well as a lot of people from elsewhere in the world. This is CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and now back to Carl.
Yes, and thank you. And this is Animal Voices, your favorite animal program on Co-op Radio, your community-sponsored and community-programmed program about animals. We're with Dr. Wayne Henry and Alart. You have a we'll be speaking with him about the challenge of environmental ethics and what we do to the planet, the morals of it. But before we do that, Alart has a question about cell stems.
Yeah, stem cells. Yes. Well, when you were mentioning about the Supreme Court upholding the right to using animals in any way because it asserts a religious freedom, then I was thinking about some programs that I did on chimeras, which is stem cell research where they're combining animal and human cells. And in Britain, where they're doing this, there's been a religious brouhaha going on lately because the bishops are coming into it saying, well, you know, we don't want you to create these things in the first place, but if you are, then you have to allow these to grow to fruition because they are part human now. So it seems like, on the one hand, religious freedom, as you say, is being upheld by the courts, that you can do whatever you want to animals and degrade them and sacrifice them and do whatever in the name of religious freedom. And yet here we have the bishops who are saying, in the name of religion, that you cannot sacrifice anything that would be part human. Do you want to respond to that?
I think that what it really reveals is how we think about animals. The truth is that humans are regarded as having an inherent worth, rightly in my opinion. Therefore, if the thing is human, if stem cells are human, then they're deserving of the same rights and protections as other humans. And we have to make all the usual calculations where conflicts of rights are involved, as, for example, say, in the abortion issue. And it can be a difficult process, to be sure. But notice in the case of animals, the right to religious freedom on the part of humans completely trumps even their most basic right, which is the right to life. And that's simply because, frankly, in the view that prevails in our society at large, as reflected in these Supreme Court decisions, animals do not have intrinsic worth and they don't have any rights.
Although now, too, we see in the news, we have Michael Vick, who's in the news, this NFL player, who has been accused of having a dogfighting ring and is being charged. And there's a whole lot of uproar with regards to the treatment of animals there.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of the most shocking and disgusting forms of animal abuse. Animals killing each other for our amusement. And what's even this is a slight aside, but what shocks me most about people who indulge in that kind of entertainment is that they will often say, sounds palpably ridiculous to me, but they'll often say such things as, "Oh, but I love my dogs." Well, that's not obvious from your behavior, but setting that aside for the moment, what really will come of this issue? There's some pressure right now on the NFL team, of which he is a member, to have the team cut him loose. And it will be interesting to see whether or not the public opinion is strong enough to actually accomplish that goal. If it is, that in itself will be a significant victory for changing our view about animals, because that will indicate something about the changing tide of opinion in the public at large. So I'll be watching that with great interest.
And it'll be interesting to see what kind of penalties are served upon either Michael Vick or whoever is found guilty of this, whether they be sent to jail, whether they only get a fine. What will be the penalty?
Again, the penalties tend to be pretty minimum, because although there are laws against explicit animal cruelty, they are still regarded merely as property, and it's always really messy in the court. If this guy owns this dog, it's going to be a very difficult issue to prove that it was cruelty, for one thing. And even if that it can be established in court, the penalties tend to be pretty minimum, because it is, after all, it remains his dog. And that's the whole reason why changes in the laws require that we first revise the notion that animals, not just dogs, but animals are property. And there's going to be an immense amount of resistance to that because of the potential implications it could have for agribusiness.
Now, back to the environment, which has been very much the news in all the media. And it, of course, presents certain types of challenges because ethics and morals are involved. I don't think most people talk about it. But so maybe I'd like to have you comment on maybe what actions are morally permissible. And I'll give an example here. Suppose that putting out a natural fire, it's a natural fire, started by lightning strike. Or culling feral animals, or destroying some individual members of what is considered to be overpopulated indigenous species is necessary for the protection of the integrity of a certain ecosystem. That puts it at the people who have to make that decision at quite a dilemma. How would you deal with that in a moral issue and explain that?
Well, there's no simple answer to the question you just asked, of course, and I probably won't adequately respond to everything you raised, but a couple of points I'd like to make are the following. First of all, my position, which, as I've already indicated, owes a great deal to the views of Tom Regan, who wrote the book The Case for Animal Rights, is the view that these animals who share these similarities with us that I alluded to earlier have an inherent worth, and that's the basis on which they're deserving of protection. I do not, for my own part, feel that trees and other inanimate life forms are share those properties, therefore they're not deserving of the same rights and protections. Our reasons for protecting the environment is because it's necessary to do so to protect the basic rights of these animals who do have rights. In other words, I believe that decreasing the impact of human activity on habitat destruction is a vital a vital task that we must undertake, not only because of the negative implications those activities can have for human life, but also because of the implications it can have for non-human lives. If those animals are deserving of, you know, respectful treatment, then it's absolutely wrong to go in there and spoil their homes like that.
So we need to undertake to restore areas which have been mined, which have been diluted by over-farming. We have a moral obligation to restore it back to its natural ways. And what is the natural ways?
I'm not competent to talk about that, but there are also a whole host of issues with respect to the conduct of ordinary everyday business that must be changed, which allows us to return to the theme of human rights and their connection with animal rights. For example, some large food producers have for many decades now been moving into Brazil in pursuit of cheap ranch land to raise inexpensive beef. People want their burgers, but of course they don't want to pay much for them. One way to offset the costs is to move into prime grazing land in places like Brazil, where it has historically been quite cheap. Notice in doing so, though, what happens. Not only is there the negative impacts on their environment as a result of agribusiness farming, the leaching, for example, of urine and feces build up into topsoil and ultimately into underground water, the methane production that contributes to greenhouse gases, the horrific treatment of the animals within the agribusiness farm itself, but also you have the local Aboriginal farmers being pushed off their land, being marginalized, and what are they doing? It's been documented that in many cases they're moving into the rainforest, at the periphery of the rainforest, and cutting down, slashing and burning the rainforest to try and find places for themselves to grow their crops. So it magnifies the horrific impact on the environment, and there's this negative impact on the rights of humans in pushing them off their land for to accommodate the big money corporations who can afford to buy that land. So there's a whole host of interconnected issues here, but I believe that a change in our view is underway, and ultimately the outcome will be to recognize the deep need to change our business practices. I don't claim to have any expertise in what would be required to reverse the damage that's already been done or how one would restore a natural environment. I'm more concerned with bringing a halt to business as presently practiced and establishing new ways of doing business that can be compatible with the environment.
So as we look over maybe decades of environmental degradation and, of course, the increase in population and, of course, the increase in wealth which people wish to have, and I guess there's supposed to some rights that people need to afford to have every person in China a motorbike or a bicycle or a fridge. But the scale has changed now. But has the moral changed? Has the ethics changed?
Well, I firmly believe, perhaps I'm naive, but I firmly believe that our ethical views have changed. I alluded to the most significant change earlier. Look, it's only been since really, I mean, it began in the 50s, but it really gained momentum in the 70s. I'm speaking of the feminist movement, which really has made most of its gains with respect to the extension of full rights to legal equality has really been accomplished mostly since the 70s. And it has gone, in my view, hand in glove with a change in how we view women and how we permit ourselves to speak about them. So I know it can happen. I believe it can happen with respect to how we view animals as well. But it's not going to happen overnight, and it's going to take a lot of work. You mentioned earlier there is a quote. One of the first quotes you mentioned when you started the show, the second one about revolutions. How did that go exactly? Can you find it again and read it again? Because I think it's pertinent here.
Oh, sure. Non-humans will continue to be exploited. Non-humans, I guess that's animals, will continue to be exploited until there is a revolution of the human spirit. Thank you, Wayne, for being a philosopher. It goes on to say, and that will not happen without visionaries trying to change the paradigm that has become accustomed to and tolerant of patriarchal violence.
Is that here?
No, that's Robert Cohen. I think so, yeah. Maybe you would like to comment on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, you know, first of all, I want to make absolutely clear, I do not claim to be a visionary. I follow the thought of the people who are visionaries, like Tom Regan, who I've spoken of, and also, Peter Singer and others, although I don't share Peter Singer's view as utilitarian. But other people have made comments like that before, I think it's true that the human spirit, as we're calling it, is capable of revolution. I prefer to put it this way. It is possible to revolutionize people's worldview on a scale that encompasses societies, if not the globe. I think that that's basically what happened with the Enlightenment, which was the origin of the present conception of human rights. Imagine that began as recently as the late 18th century. Culminating in both the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and God knows that a lot of horrible things were done as part of that movement. But my present point is that there was really a complete revolution in human thinking with respect to how we thought of ourselves in relation to one another and so on. And I firmly believe that a similar revolution is possible with respect to how we think of animals, and I just hope I live long enough to see the day when it's realized.
And Arthur Schopenhauer said, John, he said, men are the devils of the earth, and the animals are the tormented souls.
And when you talk about animals as being property, too, it wasn't until 1929 that women were given the status of person. Prior to that, women were considered property. I mean, that's just aberrant to me. But
absolutely. It's shocking, isn't it? Think about that. 1929. I actually thought that it was a little earlier than that, but I could be wrong. But, if we're, debating a couple of years, it's really irrelevant. The significance of the point is that it's less than 100 years since we have revolutionized how we think about women. Previous to that, women were regarded as the property of their fathers until marriage, and then they became the property of their husbands, and that's the historical origins of the dowry. It was the amount of value exchanged for the hand of the bride. And an interesting thing, there's a television show recently aired, a new show on AMC called Mad Men, about advertising advertisers in the early, I believe it's set in 1960. And the remarkable thing about this show is, and I watched a lengthy documentary about the research that went into creating an historically accurate picture of New York City advertising community in 1960, and what you see in the show is you see people drinking in their offices, people smoking everywhere, in the office, in restaurants, and directly relevant to what we're now talking about is the status of women. One woman who starts the job that day is told by another woman introducing her, showing her the rounds, that she should really wear, you have nice legs, it would really be to your benefit if the men around here could see those, why don't you wear shorter skirts, honey, sort of thing. Women seeing themselves as objects and men seeing themselves the same way. If you make the assumption for the moment that the show is portraying that time period in a way that's historically accurate, it's shocking how much our perspectives have changed with respect to cigarette smoking, say, for example, as well. Drinking and driving and a whole bunch of other things, it's easily possible to envision a similar revolution in human thought with respect to animals.
In the closing 8 minutes that we have left, I'd like to concentrate on the modern dilemma. And yes, you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And our webpage, where you'll be able to listen to this program and many others, it's animalvoices.org. Thank you, Dr. Wayne Henry, for being with us today once again. Which brings into question this whole idea of, I was also watching TV, and a fellow who was 15 years ago was writing about climate change. Mm. And he said, the opposition, who people, the climate change deniers, were so convincing, I almost believe him. He said, now I questioned myself what I would say. 15, now he's going back and he's researching all these people who were so convincing towards him at that time. And he said, this guy was being financed by the coal industry. This guy was being financed by the coal industry and the motor industry. And this guy was a spokesman for the oil industry. Mm-hmm. The modern dilemma. This is capitalism working for us? Is it warping what we're doing? And are we living with a new lie every time? I came across an article in the Globe and Mail, today's Globe and Mail, telling me that the Hummer was greener than the Toyota Prius. Today's Globe and Mail. Over to you.
Well, that's a great example, Carl, because, again, I think it's significant that what we've witnessed in just the last year is a change in the public perception and maybe the public's basic thinking about global warming. A year ago, it wasn't even on the public radar screen. Imagine that. In the last election, the last federal election, which is now, like, it was just after Christmas, right? So it would be about a year and a half ago. It wasn't even an issue. Less than a year later, it was an issue, so much so that we saw Prime Minister Stephen Harper fire his then environmental minister, move another person to the portfolio. I'm sorry, their names escape my memory at the moment, and contort himself to put a very different spin on his government's position with respect to the environment because they began to recognize the very real change in public perception on the significance of this issue. So that tells me that despite whatever lies might exist, the public does eventually learn the truth, and the truth is always, of course, liberating. I might draw another analogy to this issue. For example, it's well known now because of Rights to Freedom has revealed certain documents that the tobacco industry for a long time had a lot of success with sowing doubt in the public's mind about the validity of the scientific results that established a supposed connection between smoking and lung cancer, and that was the very strategy that they used. It was to create doubt about the validity of the science that establishes the connection, and that is what, for the longest time, the oil and gas industry, for example, have been doing with respect to global warming, trying to basically establish in the public's mind that there is a lot of room for doubt about the validity of the scientific findings that allegedly establish a connection between human activity and global warming.
Now, we have a dilemma with many of our environmental organizations in that the United Nations put out a 400-page report which said that livestock production was responsible for more harmful CO2 gas emissions on the planet than all of the cars produced. It was an absolutely well-researched document, a 400-page, but nobody seems to take it up. And it involves the animals because it's livestock. It involves our environment, and it involves something which each person can do, which is eat lower on the food chain, maybe even the unthinkable, if we could mention it to these environmental organizations. Yes, dear friends, you're doing a great job, but one of the best things you could do is to go vegan.
Absolutely. I've been a vegan for 10 years, about 11 years now, and it reflects a significant change in my view. Setting that aside for the moment, though, you know, you're absolutely right. All of these issues are interconnected, and what the present change in our view regarding the environment reveals is the depth of those connections. No one as recently as 10 years ago, as far as I know, was aware of the extent of the contribution to greenhouse gases made by agribusiness farming in the form of methane gas. And the problem is further multiplied by the fact that apparently, I don't claim to have the science to know this, I take this on authority, but methane gas is actually it has a worse greenhouse effect than carbon dioxide.
Right. We've got 2 minutes left. I'm going to ask you to summarize what you've said today. But I have one personal question. Mm-hmm. And that I went to my 50th class reunion, and there was one of our students, one of the fellows who was with me at school, and he became a brother. He dedicated his life towards the humanities. Wonderful person. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, well, have you ever considered, he didn't know what vegan was. And so I said, did you ever consider the plight of the animals, the drumstick that you're eating? And he said to me, we all have conflicts. And you know what? I was so amazed, and he was right. We all have conflicts. It's the human dilemma. Now, maybe a summary of all the wonderful things, the ideas that you have, maybe in the last minute and a half.
Well, I'll try to do my best. We've talked about the idea that we must change the way we think of animals, from thinking of them as objects to thinking of them as beings like ourselves that have an inherent worth. And the grounds for this change in thought requires that we recognize in them certain similarities to ourselves. If we can make that change in our thinking, then it becomes inevitable that we would no longer regard the things we presently do to them as morally acceptable. And we've also been talking about the connection between human rights and animal rights, and we've explored the idea that the two views are not only are they not in tension, but in fact they work simpatico to extend rights to all people everywhere, because we recognize that that is in fact is necessary to address the plight of animals. You're never going to make much progress towards the elimination of animal abuse in third world countries, for example, until you can lift people out of poverty by reversing the effects of, for example, huge corporate interests like these agribusiness farms being able to move in there and pushing them off their traditional land. That's what results in the habitat destruction from people just trying to make ends meet. So we must also simultaneously work for the full extension of human rights while we also work for the extension of this basic recognition of the right to life and non-interference on the part of animals.
Thank you, John Wayne. Dr. Wayne Henry from the Department of Philosophy at Capilano College. You must be a wonderful asset there. I know some of your students. They all love you. And we're so appreciative that you've taken the time during your holiday to be with Animal Voices. And to you, the listener, thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with a vengeance.